And then I will put, here we go. Okay.
Like to call a meeting to order the ad hoc committee for Crumbling Foundations, January 25th at, well, let's see, 1:35. About to order. And could I have approval of minutes for November 16th?
So moved.
Is there a second? Anybody? Second?
I think, Lori, you have to second it.
Okay, I'll second it. All in favor?
Aye.
Any nays? Motion passes. Okay, update from Department of Housing.
I think actually the CIFSEC update is first, Lori.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, sorry about that. We'll go to that CIF update.
All right.
Pauline and other members of the team, a brief update, and we invite questions throughout this discussion as well. Let's make it as interactive as we can, please. This is Mike McGlaris. I'm the superintendent of CIFSEC. I'm pleased to be with you to give you this update today. All of you know about our website, of course, crumblingfoundations.org, and there are weekly updates printed there one form or another. There's also a section of our website called Useful Links. And we encourage you to go there because there's good stuff for you to read, including our last four audited financials, which we feel it's important for the public to have access to as a federal tax exempt. So let's go to page 2, Terry, if we can, please. Our data changes literally by the hour. But as, if you could scroll up just a bit more, thank you. As of Friday morning, the 20th, we had 2,106 claimants in our system. That's 2,106 people who have gone on and either electronically or via the mail or by personally taking their app and entered their information into our system. We have 6 terabytes of data on the Crumbling Foundations crisis now, by town, by zip code, by address, and obviously by claimant. The way that you get funding in our program is through the execution of something called a participation agreement. CIFSEC is a licensed insurance company. It holds license number 29 in the state of Connecticut, but it doesn't. It's a strange insurance company in that it doesn't issue a policy and you don't pay a premium. What you get is a participation agreement. That document that you sign as a claimant and that my staff puts in front of me for my counter signature is the document that frees up funds for the remediation, or in some cases, the reimbursement to occur. I have personally signed 925 participation agreements since the inception of the program. And we have, as of Friday, remediated almost 700 foundations or 700 families. We could be right now at 700. I'm gonna be checking with staff this afternoon, but we certainly will make that announcement when it occurs. It was that long ago that we were 600. So some really good progress is being made. Let's go to the next page, Terry. This page gives you a snapshot of our financial situation and condition right now. Everything on the green side of that page are claims that we have paid to date. Cash out the door. Checks we have cut in the satisfaction of the remediation and reimbursement of foundations. Everything on the right side of the page in blue are claims that we hold on our balance sheet. They're called statutory reserves if you're an insurance company. And right now we've paid $108.5 million, I'm rounding, in claims paid to date since January 10, 2019. And we have claims in reserve of $62 million, 600,000. What does that mean? Those are everything from claims that have been substantiated and we're holding a reserve of $190,000 until we get the actual construction proposal. It also includes actual construction proposal reserves, meaning the number that is going to be the final remediation amount. And it also includes construction that's underway, where there are 2 more, for example, installments due. And it's inside that claim reserve. Insurance companies have to hold statutory claim reserves. That's the way insurance company accounting works. and we do that here. So you can see the state of play as of 9 o'clock on the 20th of January of this year. Let's go to the next page. So that's 62557 that you saw on the previous page, known reserves for claims, claims that we're holding in reserve to pay, either because the remediation hasn't begun, or the contracts aren't final, or because the remediation is ongoing and there's some existing payments, almost $63 million in reserve. We believe that of our 539 pending claimants currently in the queue, whose files we have not yet opened and we're in the process of doing that, a good estimate of the value of those eventual reserves that we'll have to post on our balance sheet is about $82 million. If you add those two numbers together, you get $144.8 million of known, existing, and expected financial liability. That's an important point. But it's also important to note, Pauline and everyone else, that this isn't a number effective 1/2023. If you looked at this number on Monday of this week, it would have already changed. It's the way our balance sheet works. Applications come in, homes get, foundations get completed, funding arrives, funding leaves, it's constantly in flux. That $144.8 million is very important for everybody to know because we repeat it on the next page. And if you go to the next page, we'll illustrate what this really means in dollars and cents. So there is the extent, that 144.8, that's the extent of our known claim reserves and what we anticipate we'll uncover when all the pending files we currently have are opened. That's the sort of red line there. The green line is our expected revenue through up to, but not including 6/30/30, based on our estimates the current time. What is that revenue consisting of? It's consisting of roughly $11 million a year in healthy home surcharge payments, give or take, that we think we'll get 7 more installments of. It also includes 3 more installments of the $25 million of the Connecticut Bond Commission funding we were voted. And right now today, we currently have roughly $33 million of cash on hand. All that cash has been pledged because I've signed participation agreements. And one by one, those homes will kick into action and that cash will leave our shop. What we have on this page is something very important for the public to understand. We actually have, as of January 20th, 2023, more projected revenue than we have claim obligations. It's astounding. For the first time in the history of this program, since January 10, 2019, we have, technically speaking, more money coming in than we have outstanding claim obligations. But here's the kicker. Each day that goes by, we open more and more pending claimant files. And on top of it, new claimants apply. Will we use up the difference between that 144.8 and that 185.3? You bet we will between now and 2030. And so at the end of the day, as we keep track of this rolling forward of new applications and of new remediations, it looks good on paper, but as a practical matter, we already know that we will have exceeded the 185 in revenue. Most likely, my guess is by early 2026 at this point. Let's go to the next page. What we know about this crisis is in these towns. There are our claimants. Now again, that includes claimants from day one, January 10th, 2019. If you live in Vernon and you applied, you're in that 403. If you live in Vernon and I've replaced your foundation, you're still in that 403. We're keeping track of the data because we think it's very important to always have a clear count of where the claimants are. You can see those are our top 10 towns for known claimants, people who've applied to the program, people who are being remediated now. That's as of 12/31/22. A new loss run will come out at the end of January. And again, these numbers will change. It includes type one, which are, of course, our remediations, type two, which are reimbursement claims, and our pending claimants. So 88% of everything we know is in those 10 towns. No surprise, that's the epicenter of where this crisis exists. Let's go to the next page. So we can talk about claimants, but what's actually been paid? 91% of what has been paid to date is in these towns. And you can see how the remediation is progressing. These towns represent 96.7 million out of that 108 million you just saw a moment ago. Again, it confirms where the epicenter of this crisis is. No surprise to anybody who's been following what's been going on with the crumbling foundation's crisis. Are we proud of this record? My team and I, of course we are. Would we like to move a little more quickly? You bet we would. But, you know, every time it snows, the process halts a little bit. Not the process of taking applications, but the process of completing foundations. We will hit 700 probably this week. If not, next week we'll have another cause for some good celebration. Let's go to the next page. The next page deals with the most recently released Public Use Foundations report. I'm going to stop here, Pauline, and see if there are any questions on the residential side of what I have presented so far. Hearing none, we'll move on. We released a report. That report, you see the link there. It's up on the useful link section of our website. It amounts to almost 400 pages. So Public Act 21120 authorized us to set aside $175,000 from our existing budget. That's important. It wasn't new money. It was our existing budget, which was very important to remark on, because that means that that didn't get spent on a foundation. And I think that's very important to note. We had to use that money very judiciously. We began this process by trying to obtain permission and collaboration from commercial building owners, people that own shopping malls and apartment buildings and office buildings. And candidly, we couldn't get the collaboration we needed. In retrospect, and using hindsight, which is always 2020, I'm not surprised about that. We wanted to examine foundations of privately owned buildings where we couldn't possibly help that building owner ever remediate that foundation. On top of it, that building owner was going to have his or her name or his or her building in a report that is a federal tax exempt we would release to the public, and the knowledge of the condition of that building would obviously be available to the public at large, as well as to bankers and holders of debt. After about 9 or 10 attempts of trying to get this done, we stopped, and I directed my staff to divert its attention away from privately held commercial buildings to public use buildings. And specifically, I wanted to start in the 10 towns where 91% of the residential crisis exists. In other words, why start anyplace else examining public use buildings, large buildings, commercial type buildings with commercial type foundations? Why start anyplace except where the epicenter of the crisis is? We did that, and we note that in this particular report. We started with the top 10 towns. And as you can see, that link can be used to obtain a copy of the report by anyone in the public domain. Let's go to the next page. So what was our methodology? I want to give praise where it is due. Kevin Miller and others who had contact with public town officials found them to be universally accepting and open and collaborative. We were in the middle of a pandemic in every sense of that word, and some folks weren't coming into the office working remotely. It was tough. But what we decided to do was to conduct a visual examination of a minimum of 100 public use buildings to determine among those public use buildings if we had a crumbling foundations crisis. Now, I want to be clear about something. I'm getting, and I continue to get, and I'm going to continue to get for some time, calls and emails where someone says, but I have seen an office building in Summers, or I've seen an office building, public use building in Tallinn, and I'm sure it's a severity code 3. I'm not saying that the crisis does not exist. What I'm saying is we got no statistical evidence that supports that we have a public buildings crumbling foundations crisis. in the northeast corner of Connecticut. And there are two very good reasons for that. Let's define public use. It's a non-commercial building used by the public or in the service of the public good and owned and controlled by a town government. We had to use that $175,000 that we were granted very judiciously. What better way to use it as a federal tax exempt, which is what CIFSIC is, than to assist other federal tax exempts in an examination of their own buildings? What's a federal tax exempt? Any town is. You can cut a check today as a donation to municipal government, take a tax deduction from your income tax, just as you can cut a check today to CIFSIC and take a tax deduction. So our rationale was the best use of our resources, which were very limited, was to take and use our tax-exempt resources to look at tax-exempt buildings, and we did that. Let's go to the next page. Kevin Miller, many of you know Kevin. He is also, besides being a very distinguished specialist and concrete scientist, he also teaches and has taught both the first time and the remediation class for our home inspection, visual inspection program. He's a highly respected concrete person. Our object was using our visual inspection severity class coding. Again, let's be clear. We do not, with one exception, require a core test to pay a claim in CIFSIC. We use a visual inspection methodology. Using that visual inspection methodology, do we have a crisis? Did we have a crisis of some kind of significant proportion in the northeast corner among public use buildings? And that's an important point. We came to some, not rapid, but because of the pandemic, but pretty solid conclusions. Next page, Terry, please. Our goal was to determine through that visual inspection process as best we could, if we had a widespread crumbling foundations crisis outside of the residential arena. We admit, and everyone on this call should admit, that we don't have 35,000 homes with this problem. We don't have 30, we don't have 10, we don't have 5. I would have their applications if I did. But it doesn't minimize the fact that we have an enormous human crisis. People are suffering through the crumbling foundations crisis, and all of you on this call know that. People are declaring bankruptcy. People are having to evacuate their home. People are having to sell their home at a loss. But we don't appear to have a crumbling foundations crisis in public use buildings. Our goal was to determine if we did, and if we do, why, and if we don't, why not? And obviously to try to best address it, understanding that by statute, I can't cut a check for a public use building tomorrow. I'm only by law, under the Public Act, allowed to remediate a residential foundation. So that was our goal. It was very tight, it was very specific, laser-like goal. Let's go to the next page. Our findings. We don't have a crisis in public use buildings. 94% of our residential claimants, 94% of our residential claimants are severity class coded 3 or 2. 7% of the buildings we looked at are class 3 or 2. I could have gone on and spent taxpayer dollars and done another 200 public use buildings. And we're convinced that we could have come to the same conclusion. And there are two very good reasons why. Type of construction and concrete quality control. The first one of those reasons is something that nobody on this call has any control over. The second one of those reasons is something that everybody on this call has control over. And we'll talk about that in a second. Let's go to the next page. So a typical public use foundation building, like a typical commercial building, slab on grade. Here's a structural example, slab above frost walls. I'm going to move you to the next page and we'll move backwards because this is an important finding. It's a finding we already knew about, but we needed to substantiate it. This is a residential foundation example. Oxygen and moisture are our enemies, and we know that from the peridotite crisis. And under a traditional residential full basement construction process, oxygen and moisture getting into that mix and activating the sulfate attack is our enemy. We know that. Go back one page, Terry, if you would. You notice that the same sort of construction doesn't occur. So while we knew while Kevin knew, while all of us on this process knew, that commercial type public use buildings have foundations for the most part like this, and that they're structurally very different. We wanted to test our assumptions through that visual examination process. Guess what? Our assumptions were confirmed. The type of foundation is vitally important. But let's move on, because that's not the only answer as to why we don't have a crisis. Let's move on beyond that, Terry. Quality control. As a purely practical matter, do we believe that a significant amount of Modus concrete entered the public use building arena? The answer is no. We have anecdotal information in Union. We have anecdotal information in Stafford that Modus concrete did enter the construction stream in some isolated examples. But here's one thing that we have to be very mindful of, and Pauline, I'm suggesting that this group and other groups of activists can be instrumental in making this happen. PA number 21120 has mandatory aggregate source testing from quarries. As a purely practical matter, the concrete that is used in residential construction does not necessarily come from quarries. You blow up part of a roadway and another exit. That rock with the iron sulfate and the obvious coloration that would indicate pyrrhotite is trucked off. Is it trucked off to a quarry? Hell no. And that's part of your problem. So we are recommending that PA number 21120, and I've spoken to a number of regulators in the caucus about this, be changed to require concrete supplies to purchase and use aggregate only from quarries and no other source. If our goal is to halt the pyrrhotite crisis, and I'm speaking only of pyrrhotite, I know pyrite is on the menu here, but if our goal is to stop this crisis in its tracks, we must exercise tighter quality control. And that means that you can't skirt the system and get source aggregate from anyone except a quarry. Why? Because under PA 21120, they're being tested. Second recommendation, we must mandate residential concrete quality control. We have to incorporate the half dozen measures, quality control measures, that are inherent in the commercial placement of concrete into the residential placement of concrete. Is that going to make that pour more expensive? Yes. But I want to be clear with everyone. My colleagues in state government and the legislators that I deal with on a regular basis have told me time and time again that this well is going to run dry. If I approach state government for another $100 million this year, next year, the year after, or certainly my successor as superintendent does that, I'm almost 100% positive that we'll be turned down. And I can guarantee you beyond 100% that we'll be turned down if we don't legislate some changes that mandate a tighter quality control process that is very similar in parts, not in all parts, but in some parts, to the quality control process of commercial placements. So we should be getting to work, those of us who want to get to work on this, and we should make these two changes to 21120. I would be greatly surprised if you did not get 100% support from the concrete caucus. Will we get opposition from certain lobbying groups in the construction industry and home building industry? Of course we will. Will it make the commercial poor, perhaps more expensive? Absolutely. But I don't know anything more expensive than the crumbling foundations crisis now, because it's costing the taxpayers of Connecticut far, far more than these quality measures would be. So that's where we are. Public use reports, use report is up, Pauline, on our website. It is available for public consumption on our latest, useful links and latest news pages. We think it was a good exercise. I stopped it. I've returned over $50,000 of that $175,000 to the public fund so that we can use that to remediate a foundation. There was no evidence that we should have continued beyond that point. So I'll pause here, given the amount of time we've got, and see if there are any questions for me. I I must have bored everybody, Pauline, because there are no questions.
I'll make sure that the links are also up on our website, but I shared them in the chat as well, both this presentation and to the public buildings one that you shared, Mike. So that's
thank you very much. Do you want me to stay here or do you want me to leave, Pauline?
Let me just. I don't think there are. One of the discussion items is an estimate of how many people are left.
Very briefly, our earliest, Deb McCoy is asking everybody to stay. So I assume that's me. I think we've had our instructions, Pauline. our estimate of the amount of this crisis right now hovers between 3,500 and 4,000 in total. I don't think you will see more beyond that in the residential area. I will tell you, though, that we are by statute remediating homes that have suffered the ill effects of pyrrhotite. That is the only mineral in the enabling legislation. If that gets expanded in any regard, it is what it is, but I would be very, very careful. If what we expect is state government to continually cough up more money, trust me when I tell you, I had to wrestle the first $25 million to the ground. That was not a sure thing. Many, many phone calls asking whether or not it was justified, still needed. It'll be like that for the next 25. It'll be like that, Pauline, for the 25 after that. So this well is going to run dry. Be judicious in terms of solutions, particularly with respect to quality improvement. Okay? So I've been told I have to stay, so I'm here.
Thank you. I am going to. Okay. I think we have Laura, you're muted, by the way.
We're going to move on to number four update from Department of Housing.
So we have Lena Hollerin and Mike Santoro from the Department of Housing on today.
Good morning. Mike Santoro, I'm the Director of Policy and Research at State Department of Housing. Lena Hollerin, the homeowner advocate and Carmelite Foundation's manager for the Department of Housing, is here as well. I want to thank Mike for his presentation. We don't have as fancy a presentation as Mike does. And he does a great job of letting us know what's going on with the captive. Just real quick, I'm going to give you a brief update on what's going on at the department, what we see coming down the road, where we are today. So as most of you know, the Vernon Ellington Stafford Testing Program continues to be open. However, the program requires 51% of the beneficiaries have incomes at or below 50% of area median income. This has put a severe limit on the number of individuals and homeowners who can, in fact, benefit from the program. 36 homes have been tested by households that qualify as low and moderate income, and 14 households above that 36 due to the ratio that is required by the feds. We have 86 homes on the wait list for that testing program. All those households and individuals are above the 50% income limit, and therefore we're stuck, we're waiting. We need more lower income households to qualify and need to, and require or ask for testing before we'll be able to assist anyone in the higher income bracket. We've paid out about a little over $170,000 under that program. And as with the previous multi-town program, again, it's limited by the number of people who participate in the program. The manager of the program continues to work on outreach, searching for new applicants, like trying to identify homeowners who may have a need or a desire to get tested. As a matter of fact, they reached out to all households on the wait list to see if anyone had income changes during COVID which on one hand would have been good. It allowed them to get tested, but on the other hand, bad, and that their household income would have gone down. It did not result in anyone being added to that program. Lena continues to speak to homeowners, realtors, and almost everybody and their brother on a regular basis who have questions about Crumbling Foundation. Many want to ask questions anonymously. That is, they are concerned about information getting out on them, who they are, where their homes are, etc. We support that in significant detail. Confidentiality is still a major concern for many households, and I will speak on behalf of the Department of Housing. It is a significant concern for the department. There are a number of people who've indicated they have knowledge about their home being negatively affected by a Crumbling Foundation, and they have failed to inform their significant other because of the emotional concern that they have finding out that the situation would exist. We are starting to get calls in here rhetorically and see reports on homes from the early 90s. The vast majority were in the early years, which is not really surprising when you, and as everybody on this call knows, the longer the time goes by, the more affected your foundation is. So as we move on in time, that baseline, if you will, continues to move up. We are seeing, again, homes in the 90s starting to appear. Recently, Michael, multiple...
May I add a comment to your privacy concerns?
Absolutely. Please.
We have, from day one, you and I are in lockstep on this issue. We think it's very important. We have, from day one, adopted a policy of confidentiality here. We think it has proven, paid us a dividend. We think people's distress and personal distress doesn't need to be advertised. To the extent you as a claimant tell folks on Facebook or wherever you are that you're a claimant, that's up to you. But when I applied for federal tax exempt status and was being interviewed by the IRS, they asked us about our confidentiality policy and whether it was sacrosanct. And I told them, over my dead body, would we release any names of claimants? We were under an intense amount of pressure, especially during the condo situation, to release names, including to my board of directors, and I refused to do it on penalty of resignation. So we have maintained strict confidentiality from day one. We want to do that because we think it's in the public interest for people to inquire about, you know, their foundation without having to reveal a ton of information about themselves. Once they apply, they're in our system, Michael, and we know who they are. But it would take an act of God for me to tell anybody. This is a
very good. Yeah, and it's not just about the names, Mike, as I'm sure you well know. Property addresses. That's really, really what it comes down to. We've seen examples where contractors, others, have tried to access and gain information through the assessor's offices as well as through our own office for addresses. For, I will say, ulterior motives. And again, as far as the department is concerned, particularly around Crumbling Foundations, confidentiality is number
absolutely.
One.
Absolutely.
So thank you, Mike. Anyway, we've had a number of multiple individuals reach out indicating that they are having trouble finding mortgage brokers, finding a mortgage company, excuse me, that will actually write a mortgage for a house that has a known Crumbling Foundation. This may get worse, but I know it is not as large a problem with the local banks as it is with the mortgage companies. But again, a lot of that is educational, I will say. Also, some banks are requiring testing before they will refinance. That's a new one. Haven't seen that a lot, but that may grow as well, particularly as interest rates continue to rise and mortgage financing becomes more competitive. We have actually had a number of homes identified positively through that process. Same with insurance brokers. Some of them have indicated they're having trouble finding a homeowner's insurance company that will write a new policy for a soon-to-be acquired home that has a known crumbling foundation. Just something I think we need to keep an eye on. One last item I'll throw out. Those of you who follow the legislative process should be aware. I believe there are 4 bills out now that affect crumbling foundations, or as Mike talked about, content of aggregate. We will be keeping an eye on that legislation and anything else that comes up. There's one in particular that talks about limiting, reducing, or eliminating that homeowner surcharge on property insurance. That one is of particular interest to us, and I'm sure it's a particular interest to CIFSIC as well. There is no actual language out on it yet, and we are curious to see what the intent of that particular piece of legislation is. We will obviously be working to oppose anything which would limit that current revenue stream. But we'll be happy to keep informed.
That's go ahead, Mike. That's particularly true since I've already spent the $77 million, Michael.
Yeah, theoretically, there you go.
So let's make sure we get the money so that I don't have to use my own Visa card on this one. Okay.
Thanks. You got it. That's about it from my side of the shop. Lena, I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
No, I think you covered it all.
All right. If anybody has questions, Lena or I will be happy to try to answer them as best we can.
Mike and Lena, if you can keep me in the loop with regards to the bills, bill numbers, and where the things are on the Crumbling Foundation's issues, if it needs to be flagged on CROG side, we'll definitely do that.
Sure thing, Pauline. I'll get the public act. I'll get the bill numbers shot off to you shortly. I should be able to include a link to those bills as well, so you can actually see. There's not a lot of real language behind them right now. They're concept bills. They still have to go through committee. Actual language has to get drafted. But the fact that they're thinking about it, talking about it, means we got to keep it on our radar.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mike, anybody have any questions?
Oops, Mike, it's your brother-in-law.
no, it can't be. How are you, Jim?
Good. How are you? Well, I was just going to mention that if you do run into people who are desperate for actual physical testing of their foundations, we have our federal grant and we're able to do free testing through UConn. So you can certainly send people to that. I can put the email address for the request form in the chat if you'd like. But there's no cost to homeowners for that.
Okay. Are you limiting who can access that money?
No. It's open to any homeowner that wants to have it tested.
If you want to send it along, we'll pass it along to the program manager for the Vernon testing program, as well as Lena will have it. If they get any homeowners who reach out, listen, every resource we can access, we want to put on the table. Thanks, Jim.
Hey, Jim, are we allowed to, this is Megan from Jill Courtney's office. Are we allowed to advertise that? Or yes. Is that okay? So we could post about it like on, you know, in the newsletter or something like that.
Most definitely.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks.
That's great. Does anybody else have any questions? If not, moving on to number 5, staff reports.
So that's me. I'm just going to do a brief update on the foundation.
Pauline, I'm going to sign off because that's probably not anything that you need me for, Terry, either. Thank you, everyone. Good to be with you all. Goodbye. Bye-bye now.
Thanks, Terry. We have the testing, the foundation testing continues to continues, and we are getting requests for reimbursement. We have had 3,640 applications to date and have paid 3,318. And that was extended. It was due in December, but DOH extended that as well. So we're continuing with the foundation testing. As you know from our last meeting, we are still waiting for HUD on the on the $2 million community funding from Congressman Courtney's office. And that is, we're waiting on HUD. So we continue to, Megan has been great, and we continue to power NAG, and we will, when that comes, when we have the NOGA and when we have some things in place, we will start moving and advertising on that. So that's my update.
If I can jump in real quick, Pauline, HUD reached out to us with regard to that funding through you guys. It does mm-hmm. require an environmental review, both a tier review as well as an individual site review. My department has agreed to provide that service. Don't know if HUD informed you or not. So we'll be working with HUD on the back end relative to supporting your initiative.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I'm in touch with Miguel Rivera from DOH on that. So we'll be working with him for that environmental review. But the environmental review piece aside, we're still actually waiting on just any kind of grant contracting information from HUD as well. So we'll get there at some point in time.
It's not just CROG too. I would say all of the HUD ones are going really, really slowly. I think there may just be a single person at HUD doing them for everyone, thousands. So you're not the only one, but none of ours have received their money yet of the five.
Yeah, most
you might
of those,
even be the furthest along.
Most of those come out of the Kansas City office. Yeah, it'll be a bit, but don't. It's about patience and perseverance. It's not about speed when it comes to HUD.
That's right.
So that's my update.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Mike. So we have a few other questions. I think we answered the first one, estimate of how many people left with the bad foundations. We did receive that information. The next one is, how can we help people with the remaining bad foundations? Debbie, maybe this is something, do you think we should have another something in the spring for residents?
You're talking to me? Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mike did present it just a few minutes ago about the remediation scheme is about Paratite. However, I found a homeowner in Stamford, Connecticut. Her home travelers went out and did the core test, and they found that her home does not have Paratite, but it has pyrite. But the same exact map cracking, deterioration, the foundation looks identical to the foundations that we have in this region. We won't probably have a lot of pyrite homes, but we do now have a case standing that there is a home with pyrite in Stamford. And the problem is that the traveler's report states on page 5, this home does not have Paratite, but it does have pyrite. They're both iron sulfide minerals. They're cousins to each other. The only difference is Paratite oxidizes 100 times faster. So our homes might show it in 10 years. Their home might show it in 12. But the gist of it is the home was built in 2003, 20 years ago, and now the damages are there and they're extremely pertinent to the conversation. The second thing is about 5 to 6 homeowners have contacted me and said, I'm from out of state. I purchased a home. Many of them are in the town of South Windsor, where the asking price, you know, are about $400,000 to $500,000. They paid full price, moved from out of state to their home. And then when that really bad rainstorm we had, their foundation was flooded. They removed the finished basement, the dry, whatever you call that, the drywall, and found that their foundation had Paratite. Now they've paid the asking price, but the problem is one of the caveats to get on the remediation scheme is you have to have a home inspection. They waived the home inspection. So I want to nip this in the bud while there's only a few, while we can contain it and not have widespread, because the market has improved. So homes are selling in a day or two. But the problem is that these home buyers are trying to win the bidding war. So a realtor will say to them, the best way to win it is by waiving the home inspection. They waive it and then find out their home is worthless. They try to apply to CIPSIC and they can't because they waived the home inspection. On the realty disclosure closing documents, it should state, if you waive a home inspection, you waive your right to access the remediation scheme if you later find out your foundation is affected. So those are the two pieces of legislation that I sent to the legislators in December 2022. And Representative Del Necky's staffer wrote back to me and said that they are going to bring those two up in a bill. One is to include pyrite, and the other is to include a disclaimer, a disclosure that if you waive a home inspection, you waive your right to access. Because I completely understand Michael's point of view that we, you know, this isn't a money trick. His resources are very limited. So, you know, it's out there in the public domain, but it's not out there in the out of region area. This homeowner that I'm speaking of, she's three times triple whammy. She has travelers, but travelers said they will not avail the $25,000 to her unless she is admitted onto the remediation scheme. She has pyrite and not peridotite. She did a home inspection, but not a home inspection with a core exam. So therefore, she's, you know, double whammy. She can't avail that $25,000. She can't avail the remediation scheme because of not doing a core exam in with that home inspect. So those were my two points that I wanted to bring up, that I did bring up to the Concrete Caucus. And Representative Del Necky Stafford did reply to my email saying that they would bring up legislation.
Debbie, do you know if that homeowner was in touch with Congressman Himes' office?
Congressman Himes' office?
Jim Himes, who represents the Fairfield County area in Congress.
No, I don't know, but I can. I did just advise her to contact her legislators in that area to get them to fight on her behalf. But I think that because pyrite and peridotite are so, you know, that pyrite can convert to peridotite at higher temps. So it's, you know, it could have started as pyrite. And I do have a photographer right now that requested the cores from travelers. The cores have been sent to him and he is reviewing them. And right now he shows pyrite. So, you know, we can't.
Okay.
I traveled all the way to Ireland to lecture the government because their remediation scheme only includes pyrite and not peridotite. And 1,500 homes have found that they have peridotite. So I went all the way to Ireland to tell them to be inclusive and have pyrite and peridotite on their remediation scheme. And I come home, and the week I get home from Ireland, I learn that a homeowner has tested positive to pyrite in Stamford.
Yeah, I would encourage them to get in touch with Congressman Himes' staff, and we're happy to support them as okay. They do that.
All right, thank you very much.
Sure.
Laurie, is there any questions? Any further questions?
I did want to bring up, we talked briefly about having another informational meeting, maybe in the spring.
Correct.
Or late spring. Time's going by pretty quick here. I don't know what anybody thinks of that or whatever. There's still a lot of people out there. Like you said, new people move into town. They don't know.
Exactly.
So I don't know what everybody's feeling is. We touched on it last month.
Mike Santoro just brought up that there are four bills right now that he knows of. So I'm wondering if what I just brought up is one of the four bills in the reality committee or.
Yes, Ms. McCoy, two of the bills you cited were in fact put out by Representative Del Necky. And they are, at least they're in committee.
Because it won't cost anything to include that disclosure in the reality closing documents. It's not like it's going to cost anything. What it'll do is save a lot of grief, because my motto is no new victims to this. No, especially since SIFSIC allows transfer claims. So when they allowed that, you have within 30 days of a closing to transfer your claim. So home sellers have the opportunity to file an application and allow that buyer, because the application follows the home, not necessarily the home owner. So with the home application in line, that new buyer can receive the transfer of claims. So there's no need for this to be creating new victims, not especially when SIFSIC has gone out of its way to allow transfer of claims.
John?
Hi, John.
Hi. A couple things. First off, for the spring conference, I would urge that if we talk about it, having some speakers of lessons learned from them going through the process, because I'm starting to think about going through the process. And all sorts of questions come up. Like we have cats living in our basement that we brought in from outside. So they're semi-feral. What do I do with them?
Yeah,
You know, it's like, is there a pet place that, or a semi pet place? But you know, it's not just weird things like that. It's like, how do you best empty your basement? You know, kind of right. Tricks that people have learned, because I hate trying to reinvent everything, and it's just stressing the hell out of me.
Well, you know, I create that guide for homeowners, the checklist for homeowners. And it does give you from step one all the way till your home is completed. However, I never took in feral cats into consideration, but one of the girls in my Concrete Queens team did set up a site called Rentals During Repairs. Yeah. And it lists all the apartments that are pet friendly. So I know Briar Knoll and Vernon.
Yeah, I have a place for myself.
Okay.
I live next to my mother-in-law, so I'll be interesting. But regardless of that, I can't take those with me because she has her own. But anyway, just I think some lessons learned from people going through would be helpful.
Yeah.
Versus a checklist, somebody you could ask questions of. And I just think getting somebody that's been through it is always best. So I recommend that. The second is that I have been trying to start getting prices, and you know, a couple of people I've talked to said, "Well, you know, you're talking summer of 2024 right now." I just wondered if that's the case, or is it just the people I'm talking to? Is what's the backlog of contractors right now? Do we have any idea? Is it a couple of years out? Is it, you know, is it too late to do this summer?
Actually, with the contractors, there's so many now that they're, you know, I admin a Facebook site, and they're, you know, when somebody posted the other day, I'm looking for a contractor, and many of them that are contractors piped in and said, you know, hey, look at me, I can do the job. So there are quite a few contractors still available to do it this year. But the ones that everyone wants, the New City, the TCFR, you know, those are booked solid. So you might have to look not so much as the ones that are tried and true, but maybe like New England Foundation Solutions, which is who my daughter's going through. They have availability and they're excellent. And under the lessons learned, one of the Concrete Queens in my group, she had her home done. She quit her job in Hartford as a litigator, and she now works for a concrete company. So she's available for to offer any kind of advice for on lessons learned and what to expect from a contractor, because the contract is between the contractor and the homeowner. So if there are any issues, it always reverts back to the contract. So when you do sign up with a contractor, make sure you ask them, when are you going to be able to do it? How long you think it's going to be take? And what are your subcontractors? Who are they? Do you have, what is that? Workers' compensation. So certain things like that, you have to really do your due diligence on that.
The other thing for the presentation is there's obviously two types of foundation replacements. Mm-hmm. You know, and we ought to have a little discussion about that too, I think, for people that have used the new, new techniques of the formed, it's not plastic, but.
The fiberglass.
It's not fiberglass either, really, but.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, so people may not know about it. And there's pros and cons to that. It's obviously faster and you can live in the house while it's going on. But you got to watch out for lawnmowers, shooting stones at it and breaking it. So, but I think a discussion of that, it cracks the stone. So I think a discussion of that too would be good, because there are options. That way you can live in your house and it's done quicker and there's less impact, but there's some longer term maintenance issues you got to be concerned about. So they meet the building code.
Right. It's market resale is what I hear the concerns about on that choice. It's just, what's the resale on selling a home that has a fiberglass foundation or whatever that material.
On the other hand, you can finish the basement off a lot easier too.
It's a composite. And yes, you can stay in your home. They don't lift your home 7 feet in the air. But there is a contractor that is on my site that says that they do it with lifting and you have to be out of your home, or you can remain in your home and they do it one wall at a time. So that's another method of repair. So there are like three or four methods of foundation repair out there that a lot of people don't know about. So very good points in the lesson learned category.
I do have a question. Very early on, we talked about doing something like an accredited contractor list. Do you remember that, Pauline?
Yeah, so CROG does the request for qualifications for contractors. So we do have that list. We maintain that list still. We have a committee of building officials who review the. It's a paper review, right, of what people have done, and we do look at their references and things like that. And the building officials, there's a few building officials who review those applications or those qualifications, and we maintain that list. And CIFSIC actually uses that list as their approved contractors. So we have that. It's not
Do we have a do not use contractor list? Because I found one contractor that was a disaster.
I don't think as a public agency we'd be able to do
that. I know, but you just don't want people to. Thing in the beginning is just to help people.
Yeah, right? We've had one in town that with the backing of the state, they made them rip out the foundation and do it again.
Right.
Maybe Deb can maintain the do not use contract.
There you go, another job for you.
I'm afraid of what might end up at my front door.
I'm not sure that we can have that have such a list like that, but we will definitely on our list on our qualified contractors, there are contractors that CIFSIC will no longer use, and that's indicated on that.
Correct. Can I just say there are a few, that people complain to me, but it's a one and done. Like, I won't name who it is, but last summer when it was raining a lot and for the whole month of July, a homeowner continually reached out to the contractor for 3 weeks, Nothing was done at her home. And the contractor never called her, wrote to her, explained what was going on, but she was in a 3-month lease and the job took longer. That was a one and done because that contractor is one of the ones that everybody wants. And there were a few of them in that same situation where there was an issue. The contractor made every effort to ratify the situation. But there is one contractor that I've heard 5 or 6 complaints about, and he's still doing it. And he's working on a home right now in one of the towns that are affected. So there is, you know, maybe one, maybe two. But for the 100%, 98% of them are excellent contractors. So that I can add.
You know, you always get that, but it's still,
yeah.
You just don't want people to get taken advantage of. They're having a hard time now. You don't want to throw any more.
Yeah. I forewarned people and then later found out client, the homeowner, contacted me and said, oh, I couldn't get that person, so I went with this person. And I was like, oh no, my God, I didn't say anything, you know, because I don't want, you know, any lawsuits. That's one of the problems that you have with this. But there's a contractor that was outstanding, that was doing the repairs way before this remediation scheme. They had one issue, and I don't want to see them, you know, being pulled from the program when they tried to make things correct, you know. But there is one contractor out there, and unfortunately they're still out there, and I don't know what to do about that, you know, which is too bad. So I can privately message you and let you know who that person is, but as far as publicly, I don't want any, you know, anyone coming at me or any bags of poop thrown at my front door, if you know what I mean.
Great. I don't have anything else. Do you, Pauline? Or is anybody else? Do we need a motion to adjourn, or Pauline?
Yeah, I think so.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Bye.
That's great. Thank you, everybody, for your time today.
Thank you, Pauline. Thank you, Pauline.